The Golden Bough. A Study of Magic and Religion. By Sir James George Frazer. This audiobook was produced by Klaus-Dieter Mond, Rastatt, Germany and is published under the conditions of the Gutenberg Organization. Chapter 24. The Killing of the Divine King. Section 2. Kings killed when their strength fails. If the high gods, who dwell remote from the fret and fever of this earthly life, are yet believed to die at last, it is not to be expected that a god who lodges in a frail tabernacle of flesh should escape the same fate, though we hear of African kings who have imagined themselves immortal by virtue of their sorceries. Now primitive peoples, as we have seen, sometimes believe that their safety and even that of the world is bound up with the life of one of these god-men or human incarnations of the divinity. Naturally, therefore, they take the utmost care of his life, out of a regard for their own. But no amount of care and precaution will prevent the man-god from growing old and feeble and at last dying. His worshippers have to lay their account with this sad necessity and to meet it as best they can. The danger is a formidable one. For if the course of nature is dependent on the man-god's life, what catastrophes may not be expected from the gradual enfeeblement of his powers and their final extinction and death? There is only one way of averting these dangers. The man-god must be killed as soon as he shows symptoms that his powers are beginning to fail, and his soul must be transferred to a vigorous successor before it has been seriously impaired by the threatened decay. The advantages of thus putting the man-god to death instead of allowing him to die of old age and disease are, to the savage, obvious enough. For if the man-god dies what we call a natural death, it means, according to the savage, that his soul has either voluntarily departed from his body and refuses to return, or more commonly that it has been extracted, or at least detained in its wanderings, by a demon or sorcerer. In any of these cases the soul of the man-god is lost to his worshippers, and with it and the proserpity is gone and their very existence endangered. Even if they could arrange to catch the soul of the dying god as it left his lips or his nostrils and so transfer it to a successor, this would not affect their purpose. For, dying of disease, his soul would necessarily leave his body in the last stage of weakness and exhaustion, and so enfeebled it would continue to drag out a languid, inert existence in any body to which it might be transferred. Whereas by slaying him his worshippers could, in the first place, make sure of catching his soul as it escaped and transferring it to a suitable successor. And, in the second place, by putting him to death before his natural force was abated, they would secure that the world should not fall into decay with the decay of the man-god. Every purpose, therefore, was answered, and all dangers averted by thus killing the man-god and transferring his soul, while yet at its prime, to a vigorous successor. The mystic kings of fire and water in Cambodia are not allowed to die a natural death. Hence when one of them is seriously ill and the elders think that he cannot recover, they stab him to death. The people of Congo believed, as we have seen, that if their pontiff the Chitomo were to die a natural death, the world would there perish, and the earth, which he alone sustained by his power and merit, would immediately be annihilated. Accordingly, when he fell ill and seemed likely to die, the man who was destined to be his successor entered the pontiff's house with a rope or a club and strangled or clubbed him to death. The Ethiopian kings of Meroe were worshipped as gods. But whenever the priests chose, they sent a messenger to the king, ordering him to die, and alleging an oracle of the gods as their authority for the command. This command the kings always obeyed down to the reign of Ergamenes, a contemporary of Ptolemy II, king of Egypt. Having received a Greek education which emancipated him from the superstitions of his countrymen, Ergamenes ventured to disregard the command of the priests, and, entering the golden temple with a body of soldiers, put the priests to the sword. Customs of the same sort appear to have prevailed in this part of Africa down to modern times. In some tribes of Fazokal the king had to administer justice daily under a certain tree. If from sickness or any other cause he was unable to discharge this duty for 3 whole days, he was hanged on the tree in a noose, which contained two razors so arranged that when the noose was drawn tight by the weight of the king's body they cut his throat. A custom of putting their divine kings to death at the first symptoms of infirmity or old age prevailed until lately, if indeed it is even now extinct and not merely dormant, among the Shilluk of the White Nile, and in recent years it has been carefully investigated by Dr. C. G. Seligman. The reverence which the Shilluk pay to their king appears to arise chiefly from the conviction that he is a reincarnation of the spirit of Nyakang, the semi-divine hero who founded the dynasty and settled the tribe in their present territory. It is a fundamental article of the Shilluk creed that the spirit of the divine or semi-divine Nyakang is incarnate in the reigning king, who is accordingly himself invested to some extent with the character of a divinity. But while the Shilluk hold their kings in high, indeed religious reverence and take every precaution against their accidental death, nevertheless they cherish the conviction that the king must not be allowed to become ill or senile, lest with his diminishing vigor the cattle should sicken and fail to bear their increase, the crops should rot in the fields, and man, stricken with disease, should die in ever-increasing numbers. To prevent these calamities it used to be the regular custom with the Shilluk to put the king to death whenever he showed signs of ill health or failing strength. One of the fatal symptoms of decay was taken to be an incapacity to satisfy the sexual passions of his wives, of whom he has very many, distributed in a large number of houses at Fashoda. When this ominous weakness manifested itself, the wives reported it to the chiefs, who are popularly said to have intimated to the king his doom by spreading a white cloth over his face and knees as he lay slumbering in the heat of the sultry afternoon. Execution soon followed the sentence of death. A hut was specially built for the occasion, the king was led into it and lay down with his head resting on the lap of a nubile virgin, the door of the hut was then walled up. And the couple were left without food, water, or fire to die of hunger and suffocation. This was the old custom, but it was abolished some 5 generations ago on account of the excessive sufferings of one of the kings who perished in this way. It is said that the chiefs announce his fate to the king, and that afterwards he is strangled in a hut which has been specially built for the occasion. From Dr. Seligman's inquiries it appears that not only was the Shilluk king liable to be killed with a due ceremony at the first symptoms of incipient decay, but even while he was yet in the prime of health and strength he might be attacked at any time by a rival and have to defend his crown in a combat to the death. According to the common Shilluk tradition, any son of a king had the right thus to fight the king in possession and, if he succeeded in killing him, to reign in his stead. As every king had a large harem and many sons, the number of possible candidates for the throne at any time may well have been not inconsiderable, and the reigning monarch must have carried his life in his hand. But the attack on him could only take place with any prospect of success at night. For during the day the king surrounded himself with his friends and bodyguards, and an aspirant to the throne could hardly hope to cut his way through them and strike home. It was otherwise at night. For then the guards were dismissed and the king was alone in his enclosure with his favorite wives, and there was no man near to defend him except a few herdsmen, whose huts stood a little way off. The hours of darkness were therefore the season of peril for the king. It is said that he used to pass them in constant watchfulness, prowling round his huts fully armed, peering into the blackest shadows, or himself standing silent and alert, like a sentinel on duty, in some dark corner. When at last his rival appeared, the fight would take place in grim silence, broken only by the clash of spears and shields, for it was a point of honor with the king not to call the herdsmen to his assistance. Like Nyakang himself, their founder, each of the Shilluk kings after death is worshipped at a shrine, which is erected over his grave, and the grave of a king is always in the village where he was born. The tomb shrine of a king resembles the shrine of Nyakang, consisting of a few huts enclosed by a fence. One of the huts is built over the king's grave, the others are occupied by the guardians of the shrine. Indeed, the shrines of Nyakang and the shrines of the kings are scarcely to be distinguished from each other, and the religious rituals observed at all of them are identical in form and vary only in matters of detail, the variations being due apparently to the far greater sanctity attributed to the shrines of Nyakang. The grave shrines of the kings are tended by certain old men or women, who correspond to the guardians of the shrines of Nyakang. They are usually widows or old men servants of the deceased king, and when they die they are succeeded in their office by their descendants. Moreover, cattle are dedicated to the grave shrines of the kings and sacrifices are offered at them just as at the shrines of Nyakang. In general, the principal element in the religion of the Xiluk would seem to be the worship which they pay to their sacred or divine kings, whether dead or alive. These are believed to be animated by a single divine spirit, which has been transmitted from the semi-mythical, but probably in substance historical, founder of the dynasty through all his successors to the present day. Hence, regarding their kings as incarnate divinities on whom the welfare of men, of cattle, and of the corn implicitly depends, the Xiluk naturally pay them the greatest respect and take every care of them. And however strange it may seem to us, their custom of putting the divine king to death as soon as he shows signs of ill health or failing strength springs directly from their profound veneration for him and from their anxiety to preserve him, or rather the divine spirit by which he is animated, in the most perfect state of efficiency. Nay, we may go further and say that and the practice of regicide is the best proof they can give of the higher regard in which they hold their kings. For they believe, as we have seen, that the king's life or spirit is so sympathetically bound up with the prosperity of the whole country, that if he fell ill or grew senile the cattle would sicken and cease to multiply, the crops would rot in the fields, and men would perish of widespread disease. Hence, in their opinion, the only way of averting these calamities is to put the king to death while he is still hale and hearty, in order that the divine spirit which he has inherited from his predecessors may be transmitted in turn by him to his successor while it is still in full vigor and has not yet been impaired by the weakness of disease and old age. In this connection, the particular symptom which is commonly said to seal the king's death warrant is highly significant. When he can no longer satisfy the passions of his numerous wives, in other words, when he has ceased, whether partially or wholly, to be able to reproduce his kind, it is time for him to die and to make room for a more vigorous successor. Taken along with the other reasons which are alleged for putting the king to death, this one suggests that the fertility of men, of cattle, and of the crops is believed to depend sympathetically on the generative power of the king, so that the complete failure of that power in him would involve a corresponding failure in men, animals, and plants, and would thereby entail at no distant to date the entire extinction of all life, whether human, animal, or vegetable. No wonder, that with such a danger before their eyes the Xiluk should be most careful not to let the king die what we should call a natural death of sickness or old age. It is characteristic of their attitude towards the death of the kings that they refrain from speaking of it as death. They do not say that a king has died but simply that he has gone away, like his divine ancestors Nyakang and Dag, the two first kings of the dynasty, both of whom are reported not to have died but to have disappeared. The similar legends of the mysterious disappearance of early kings in other lands, for example at Rome and in Uganda, may well point to a similar custom of putting them to death for the purpose of preserving their life. On the whole, the theory and practice of the divine kings of the Xiluk correspond very nearly to the theory and practice of the priests of Nemi, the kings of the wood, if my view of the latter is correct. In both we see a series of divine kings on whose life the fertility of men, of cattle, and of vegetation is believed to depend, and who are put to death, whether in single combat or otherwise, in order that their divine spirit may be transmitted to their successors in full vigor, uncontaminated by the weakness and decay of sickness or old age, because any such degeneration on the part of the king would, in the opinion of his worshippers, entail a corresponding degeneration on Manking, on cattle, and on the crops. Some points in this explanation of the custom of putting divine kings to death, particularly the method of transmitting their divine souls to their successors, will be dealt with more fully in the sequel. Meantime, we pass to other examples of the general practice. The Dinka are a congeries of independent tribes in the valley of the White Nile. They are essentially a pastoral people, passionately devoted to the care of their numerous herds of oxen, though they also keep sheep and goats, and the women cultivate small quantities of millet and sesame. For their crops and above all for the pastures, they depend on the regularity of the rains. In seasons of prolonged drought, they are said to be reduced to great extremities. Hence the rainmaker is a very important personage among them to this day. Indeed, the men in authority whom travelers dub chiefs or sheikhs are in fact the actual or potential rainmakers of the tribe or community. Each of them is believed to be animated by the spirit of a great rainmaker, which has come down to him through a succession of rainmakers. And in virtue of this inspiration, a successful rainmaker enjoys very great power and is consulted on all important matters. Yet in spite, or rather in virtue, of the high honor in which he is held, no Dinka rainmaker is allowed to die a natural death of sickness or old age. For the Dinka believed that if such an untoward event were to happen, the tribe would suffer from disease and famine, and the herds would not yield their increase. So when a rainmaker feels that he is growing old and infirm, he tells his children that he wishes to die. Among the Aga Dinka, a large grave is dug and the rainmaker lies down in it, surrounded by his friends and relatives. From time to time he speaks to the people, recalling the past history of the tribe, reminding them how he has ruled and advised them, and instructing them how they are to act in the future. Then, when he has concluded his admonition, he bids them cover him up. So the earth is thrown down on him as he lies in the grave, and he soon dies of suffocation. Such, with minor variations, appears to be the regular end of the honorable career of a rainmaker in all the Dinka tribes. The Khorabda Dinka told Dr. Seligman that when they have dug a grave for their rainmaker, they strangle him in his house. The father and paternal uncle of one of Dr. Seligman's informants had both been rainmakers and both had been killed in the most regular and orthodox fashion. Even if a rainmaker is quite young, he will be put to death should he seem likely to perish of disease. Further, every precaution is taken to prevent a rainmaker from dying an accidental death, for such an end, though not nearly so serious a matter as death from illness or old age, would be sure to entail sickness on the tribe. As soon as a rainmaker is killed, his valuable spirit is supposed to pass to a suitable successor, whether a son or other near blood relation. In the Central African Kingdom of Bunyoro, down to recent years, custom required that as soon as the king fell seriously ill or began to break up from age, he should die by his own hand. For, according to an old prophecy, the throne would pass away from the dynasty if ever the king were to die a natural death. He killed himself by draining a poisoned cup. If he faltered or were too ill to ask for the cup, it was his wife's duty to administer the poison. When the king of Kibanga, on the Upper Congo, seems near his end, the sorcerers put a rope round his neck, which they draw gradually tighter till he dies. If the king of Jinjiro happens to be wounded in war, he is put to death by his comrades, or, if they fail to kill him, by his kinsfolk, however hard he may beg for mercy. They say they do it that he may not die by the hands of his enemies. The Jukus are a heathen tribe of the Benue River, a great tributary of the Niger. In their country, the town of Gatri is ruled by a king who is elected by the big men of the town as follows. When in the opinion of the big men the king has reigned long enough, they give out that the king is such a formula understood by all to mean that they are going to kill him, though the intention is never put more plainly. They then decide who is to be the next king. How long he is to reign is settled by the influential men at a meeting. The question is put and answered by each man throwing on the ground a little piece of stick for each year he thinks the new king should rule. The king is then doled, and a great feast prepared, at which the king gets drunk on guinea corn beer. After that he is speared, and the man who was chosen becomes king. Thus each Juko king knows that he cannot have very many more years to live, and that he is certain of his predecessor's fate. This, however, does not seem to frighten candidates. The same custom of king killing is said to prevail at Kwernd and Wakari as well as at Gatri. In the three Hausa kingdoms of Gabur, Katsina, and Dahira, in northern Nigeria, as soon as a king showed signs of failing health or growing infirmity, an official who bore the title of Killer of the Elephant appeared and throttled him. The Mashamba is a great king or emperor in the interior of Angola. One of the inferior kings of the country, by name Chala, gave to a Portuguese expedition the following account of the manner in which the Mashamba comes by his end. "It has been customary," he said, "for our Mashambas to die either in war or by a violent death, and the present Mashamba must meet this last fate, as, in consequence of his great exactions, he has lived long enough. When we come to this understanding, and decide that he should be killed, we invite him to make war with our enemies, on which occasion we'll accompany him and his family to the war, when we lose some of our people. If he escapes unhurt, we return to the war again and fight for 3 or 4 days. We then suddenly abandon him and his family to their fate, leaving him in the enemy's hands. Seeing himself thus deserted, he causes his throne to be erected, and, sitting down, calls his family around him. He then orders his mother to approach. She kneels at his feet. He first cuts off her head, then decapitates his sons in succession, next his wives and relatives, and, last of all, his most beloved wife, called Anakalo. This slaughter being accomplished, the Mashamba, dressed in all his pomp, awaits his own death, which immediately follows, by an officer sent by the powerful neighboring chiefs, Kanikwinha and Kanika. This officer first cuts off his legs and arms at the joints, and lastly he cuts off his head. After which the head of the officer is struck off. All the potentates retire from the encampment, in order not to witness his death. It is my duty to remain and witness his death, and to mark the place where the head and arms have been deposited by the two great chiefs, the enemies of the Mashamba. They also take possession of all the property belonging to the deceased monarch and his family, which they convey to their own residence. I then provide for the funeral of the mutilated remains of the late Mashamba, after which I retire to his capital and proclaim the new government. I then return to where the head, legs, and arms have been deposited, and, for 40 slaves, I ransom them, together with the merchandise and other property belonging to the deceased, which I give up to the new Mashamba, who has been proclaimed. This is what has happened to many Mashambas, and what must happen to the present one. It appears to have been a Zulu custom to put the king to death as soon as he began to have wrinkles or grey hairs. At least this seems implied in the following passage written by one who resided for some time at the court of the notorious Zulu tyrant Chaka. In the early part of the 19th century, the extraordinary violence of the king's rage with me was mainly occasioned by that absurd nostrum, the hair oil, with the notion of which Mr. Farewell had impressed him as being a specific for removing all indications of age. From the first moment of his having heard that such a preparation was attainable, he evinced a solicitude to procure it, and on every occasion never forgot to remind us of his anxiety respecting it. More especially on our departure on the mission, his injunctions were particularly directed to this object. It will be seen that it is one of the barbarous customs of the Zolas in their choice or election of their kings that he must neither have wrinkles nor grey hairs, as they are both distinguishing marks of disqualification for becoming a monarch of a warlike people. It is also equally indispensable that their king should never exhibit those proofs of having become unfit and incompetent to reign. It is therefore important that they should conceal these indications so long as they possibly can. Chaka had become greatly apprehensive of the approach of grey hairs, which would at once be the signal for him to prepare to make his exit from this sublunary world, it being always followed by the death of the monarch. The writer to whom we are indebted for this instructive anecdote of the hair oil omits to specify the mode in which a grey-haired and wrinkled Zulu chief used to make his exit from this sublunary world. But on analogy we may conjecture that he was killed. The custom of putting kings to death as soon as they suffered from any personal defect prevailed 2 centuries ago in the Kaffra kingdom of Sofala, We have seen that these kings of Sofalar were regarded as gods by their people, being entreated to give rain or sunshine, according as each might be wanted. Nevertheless, a slight bodily blemish, such as a loss of a tooth, was considered a sufficient cause for putting one of these godmen to death. As we learn from the following passage of an old Portuguese historian, it was formerly the custom of the kings of this land to commit suicide by taking poison when any disaster or natural physical defect fell upon them, such as impotence, infectious disease, the loss of their front teeth, by which they were disfigured, or any other deformity or affliction. To put an end to such defects, they killed themselves, saying that the king should be free from any blemish, and if not, it was better for his honor that he should die and seek another life where he would be made whole, for there everything was perfect. But the Quitev king, who reigned when I was in those parts, would not imitate his predecessors in this, being discreet and dreaded as he was. For having lost a front tooth, he caused it to be proclaimed throughout the kingdom that all should be aware that he had lost a tooth and should recognize him when they saw him without it. And if his predecessors killed themselves for such things, they were very foolish, and he would not do so. On the contrary, he would be very sorry when the time came for him to die a natural death, for his life was very necessary to preserve his kingdom and defend it from his enemies. And he recommended his successors to follow his example. The king of Sofala, who dared to survive the loss of his front tooth, was thus a bold reformer like Ergamenes, king of Ethiopia. We may conjecture that the ground for putting the Ethiopian kings to death was, as in the case of the Zulu and Sofala kings, the appearance on their person of any bodily defect or sign of decay. And that the oracle which the priests alleged as the authority for the royal execution was to the effect that great calamities would result from the reign of a king who had any blemish on his body. Just as an oracle warned Sparta against a lame reign, that is, the reign of a lame king. It is some confirmation of this conjecture that the kings of Ethiopia were chosen for their size, strength, and beauty long before the custom of killing them was abolished. To this day, the Sultan of Wadi must have no obvious bodily defect, and the king of Angoy cannot be crowned if he has a single blemish, such as a broken or a filed tooth or the scar of an old wound. According to the Book of Akkal and many other authorities, no king who was afflicted with a personal blemish might reign over Ireland at Tara. Hence, when the great king Cormac Mac Art lost one eye by an accident, he at once abdicated. Many days' journey to the northeast of Abomey, the old capital of Daomey, lies the kingdom of Ayo. The Ayo's governed by a king, no less absolute than the king of Daomey, yet subject to a regulation of state, at once humiliating and extraordinary. When the people have conceived an opinion of his ill government, which is sometimes insidiously infused into them by the artifice of his discontented ministers, they send a deputation to him with a present of parrot's eggs, as a mark of its authenticity, to represent to him that the burden of government must have so far fatigued him that they consider it full time for him to repose from his cares and indulge himself with a little sleep. He thanks his subjects for their attention to his ease, retires to his own apartment as if to sleep, and there gives directions to his women to strangle him. This is immediately executed, and his son quietly ascends the throne upon the usual terms of holding the reins of government no longer than whilst he merits the approbation of the people. About the year 1774, a king of Ayo, whom his ministers attempted to remove in the customary manner, positively refused to accept the proffered parrot's eggs at their hands, telling them that he had no mind to take a nap, but on the contrary was resolved to watch for the benefit of his subjects. The ministers, surprised and indignant at his recalcitrancy, raised a rebellion, but were defeated with great slaughter, and thus by his spirited conduct the king freed himself from the tyranny of his counsellors and established a new precedent for the guidance of his successors. However, the old custom seems to have revived and persisted until late in the 19th century, for a Catholic missionary, writing in 1884, speaks of the practice as if it were still in vogue. Another missionary, writing in 1881, thus describes the usage of the Egbers and the Yorubas of West Africa, Among the customs of the country, one of the most curious is unquestionably that of judging and punishing the king. Should he have earned the hatred of his people by exceeding his rights, one of his counselors, on whom the heavy duty is laid, requires of the prince that he shall go to sleep, single quote, which means simply, take poison and die. Single quote, if his courage fails him at the supreme moment, a friend renders him this last service, and quietly, without betraying the secret, they prepare the people for the news of the king's death. In Europe, the thing is managed a little differently. When a son is born to the king of Oyo, they make a model of the infant's right foot in clay and keep it in the house of the elders, Ogboni. If the king fails to observe the customs of the country, a messenger, without speaking a word, shows him his child's foot. The king knows what that means. He takes poison and goes to sleep. The old Prussians acknowledged as their supreme lord a ruler who governed them in the name of the gods, and was known as God's Mouth. When he felt himself weak and ill, if he wished to leave a good name behind him, he had a great heap made of thorn bushes and straw, on which he mounted and delivered a long sermon to the people, exhorting them to serve the gods and promising to go to the gods and speak for the people. Then he took some of the perpetual fire which burned in front of the holy oak tree, and lighting the pile with it burned himself to death.